Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, Adlai Stevenson III is our guest. He has compiled the Black Book, American Politics and History, as experienced by five generations of an American family. And it includes Senator Adlai Stevenson himself, who occupied the seat that President Obama later claimed. And he writes in a letter, which we'll talk about, a New Year's message to the president, all that happened during the 70s in Congress when he was a United States senator. It also includes thoughts and writings from Governor Adlai Stevenson from Illinois, his father, and Vice President Adlai E. Stevenson. And it's a lovely book filled with quotes from his father and from other famous people, and is a collection of what they used to collect, actually. His great-grandfather collected anecdote, humor, and wisdom in a binder during his life as a county prosecutor, a congressman, assistant postmaster general, and vice president under Grover Cleveland. And then his grandson, Adlai Stevenson, expanded the Black Book during his life as an official in the Roosevelt and Truman administration, governor of Illinois, and Democratic presidential candidate in 1952 and 1956, and U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Their family history is very, very rich and goes back all the way. We'll get to that during this hour, to becoming very involved in making sure that Abraham Lincoln secured the Republican nomination in 1860. So you can't beat that. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Senator Stevenson, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm a regular listener of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm delighted to be with you. Thank you.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. And I must tell you my little family connection here, because my grandmother, who lived in Libertyville, Illinois, with my grandfather, was a huge and helped to organize the Northern Illinois campaign for your father in 1956. And she is the one who got me interested in politics, because I used to go there on Sundays and watch Meet the Press and hear her talk about politics. So it's an honor to speak with you, sir.
Well, it's my privilege. And if your aunt was a supporter of my father in Libertyville, she was something of a rarity. That was a
right,
very Republican community.
Yeah, she was a rarity. She was a great woman, a suffragist,
yeah,
and a marvelous woman. Is the farm in Libertyville still there?
Yes, and it's now owned by the Lake County Forest Preserve District.
Oh.
Interesting, you call it the farm. We always called it the farm. It was our base, you know, over the years. We'd be in Washington or London or somewhere in the world, but that was home. And it's now home for the Adlai Stevenson Center on Democracy. And the basic idea is to try to bring people together from around the world, practitioners, together with the experts, and try to address systemic weaknesses in democratic systems of government. It's been difficult in this economic environment getting it, off the ground, but we are doing programs regularly on various aspects of politics and trying to continue the tradition.
Oh, I would love to come sometime. It would be a lovely place to see. And the tradition, I had no idea that the family tradition really goes all the way back to Abraham Lincoln.
Well, this man figures largely in my book, because he is the exemplary American citizen. And in the Black Book, which always idealizes politics, but sometimes realizes politics, for the American citizen, service was a welcome obligation. Service to community, service to a country. Jesse Fell made money speculating land. He gave it all back. He founded the first public university beyond the Appalachians. He founded towns and orphanages, planted parks, etc. And he is recorded in the Black Book by my great-grandfather, Adlai One, who was then a student, proposing to Senator Stephen A. Douglas the, quote, joint discussions of the then transcendental issue, slavery in the territories, with a lawyer-legislator named Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, my gosh.
The debates, seven of them, 3 hours each, brought people by the thousands on horseback and wagon to be a part of their politics. But those debates also, as Fell intended, this remarkable man, overlooked by history, they brought Lincoln to the nation's attention. And in some ways, they sort of fixed our future, the country's future. And then Lincoln gave him his autobiographical sketch, which Jesse Fell used to promote Lincoln's candidacy for the president. He was secretary of the Republican Party and organized the 1860 Illinois State delegation to the National Convention for Abraham Lincoln. Without this citizen, there might never have been Abraham Lincoln the president.
Oh, my goodness. Isn't that something to ponder?
And he never asked anything. So he's overlooked by history.
Yeah. What does it mean? Your family also has Illinois in the bones and in the blood. What does that mean to you?
Oh, well, our roots, run deep in Illinois, central Illinois. Jesse Fell arrived in 1830. He also organized and published the Daily Pantograph, the newspaper. Imagine that. Every community had its paper. Every paper had its community. But Pantograph, it signified something of First Amendment obligations and knowledge of the classics, the Greek classics, in the 1830s. So, our roots go deep, and not just in politics, but in journalism and farming. We're still farming. And, of course, in big city politics. And then as the universe, America's universe, expanded, ours did in the world. We never stopped sort of studying the world from within it, on the ground, outside the prism of the West, which most people view it. My father really was a student of the world.
Yes, and he brought you to various parts of the world when you were quite young, didn't he?
Oh, he started at the age of 15 in London when he was one of the architects of the United Nations. And I've never stopped. The Black Book, as you noticed, ends with an epilogue on the life cycle of nations and empires and with me in China. But I've lived, worked, and, just traveled in, studied in well, I stopped counting at 80. When I heard that Secretary Clinton claimed she'd been to 80 countries, I started counting. When I hit 80, I quit. Of course, a lot of them were colonies, back in the 50s when we first visited them. So I may be cheating a little there to include as countries, places that were then colonies.
I must bring up what the way your father was described, and you as well, which I always thought was an enormous compliment, but you've heard this before. If you've heard it once, you've heard it a million times, that your father was just too much of an egghead, that your family is simply too intelligent, and you're way over the heads of the American public.
Yeah, he was, though, a hard-boiled egghead. he was a reform governor. He really cleaned up the state of Illinois. And in those days, he was elected against all the odds, in 48. I was his driver during that campaign, from courthouse to courthouse, factory gate to factory gate, the ward meetings at night. That campaign cost $157,000.
Oh my gosh, no.
And he recruited first-rate professionals to head the departments, commissions, and so on. They didn't pay to play. You sacrifice to serve in those days. But he had a wonderful sense of humor. And he was intelligent. He was highly articulate. And he used those campaigns for the presidency to develop the program, which became the foundation for the New Frontier and the Great Society. But for him, as I try to point out in the book, democracy is not a device for winning elections. It's a system for informing the people so they can make a sound judgment. Trust the people with the truth, he said. And in half-hour blocks of time on national television to enthusiastic audiences, eloquently and substantively, he did exactly that. Eisenhower ran against him on a promise of change, but it was the defeated Stevenson who delivered the change.
Hmm.
The opposition, you know, did more than oppose in those days.
At some point in the book, I was hungry for more information, you write that if Dwight Eisenhower had known that Stevenson was going to run, he wouldn't have run?
Well, I was quoting Hedley Donovan, who was then the editor-publisher of Time Life. But I shouldn't perhaps say this, but I have since had that confirmed by one of the Eisenhower grandchildren. But, yeah, I think I have a record of Hedley Donovan saying that, but, you know, I my sources are secondary. I didn't hear Eisenhower say that.
Let me just read a list that you include, which I find astounding, of the people who were in the mansion in Illinois when your father was governor. Carl Sandburg, John Steinbeck, just a few of them, Edward R. Murrow, Walter Lippmann, Arthur Rubinstein, Bob Hope, the creative, curious, and influential, trekked to Springfield to be with your father?
Well, he was an extraordinary phenomenon. He was an architect of the United Nations, a New Deal bureaucrat, a senior official in the Roosevelt and Truman administrations. He had no base in politics other than, you know, the sort of family tradition. And all of a sudden he was governor of Illinois with this extraordinary and very improbable experience behind him. Speaking, reforming state government at the same time that he was, you know, America's face to the world. Those campaigns excited the world, made him a hero throughout the world. So, yes, and he didn't want to run for president. They trekked there, and the party drafted him after a, you know, welcoming speech at the, he didn't enter any primaries at all. And when he was drafted to that convention, he had no staff, he had no, you know, no money, no
Hard
program.
Hard to believe.
It started from scratch at the convention.
Hard to believe.
And it went on to electrify the world.
And you were solicited to run as well.
In 1976, had just been reelected by almost 2-1 in Illinois, and Richard J. Daley, the legendary Richard J. Daley, the boss. He was mayor of Chicago, but more importantly, he was chairman of the Cook County Regular Democratic Organization. He was the boss, but yet much of his power was derivative. It came from the ward committee men and the central committee men and so on. But yes, he asked me to run for president in 1976. I'd been asked by him from time to time to, you know, head the ticket, and it always delivered. I'd been state rep as well as state treasurer and elected twice to the United States Senate at that point. But I decided that I wasn't, I just wasn't ready, although in retrospect, I think it may have been as ready as the next, you know, the next. And then he asked me to run as a favorite son. Which I did in Illinois and picked up. That was a way of picking up delegates. Which we eventually released to Jimmy Carter, clinching his nomination. I think, you know, Daley did that, tried to get me to run for multiple reasons. One was just to collect delegates. And, you know, I might win, but even if I didn't, it would be a way of collecting delegates that would make him an influence at the convention.
Right. You wrote an interesting letter, which is included in the book, on January 3rd to the current president, because you did occupy the Senate seat that he later claimed, so you have every right in the world to write him such a letter. But it's interesting, and I'd like for you to contrast, Senator Stevenson, more of what was going on in Congress, the great flood of legislation, war on poverty, environmental legislation, that was taking place. Of course, Vietnam was taking place then, too. But this spirit of let's work on things maybe more together than we are now. Yeah. Is it a stark contrast?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to contrast, I want to bring out to contrast the values that created this country with those today which are undermining it. In the Senate that I entered, I don't remember any partisanship. We didn't divide on issues, with even Watergate, Vietnam, along party lines. We worked across the lines. And to work to do many of the things that that President Obama is calling for now, technology innovation and utilization, for example. I authored those programs, which led to the great burst of information technologies in the 90s, the environmental legislation, and later under Carter, all of the Department of Energy, the development of alternative sources of energy. It's a long litany, and it started, and since writing that letter, I've suddenly gone back and thought, great night, I've really missed something. I thought it was, just nonpartisanship. We were there to serve the Senate, to serve the people. But as I thought about it, by today's standards, Richard Nixon is a liberal activist. Hmm. Many of these programs, consumer protection, product safety, mine safety, these activist programs of the federal government, were many of them initiated or at least supported by Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. He even imposed wage and price controls. And some of this continued under Gerald Ford, my legislation to protect pensions and prevent them from being, raided was signed into law by Gerald Ford. So what happened? By today's standards, these are left-wing Democrats.
How do you answer that? What happened?
Well, the glib answer, and I've been thinking about this too, everything started changing in the 70s and late in the 70s. Ronald Reagan was considered a sort of a fringe character. He was celluloid and off the map as late as 1976. In fact, George Bush, the senior, called his trickle-down supply-side economics voodoo economics until George ran for vice president and became a believer. But ideology began to approach. As ideologues were leaving Beijing, ideologues were arriving in Washington with Reagan and the, quote, magic of the marketplace. Taxes were cut. Resources were shifted to the military. And, of course, didn't work. The budget plunged into a deficit. But something else was happening. The costs of campaigning were going up. The media was becoming, electric and expensive. The messages were getting trivialized and condensed into 30-second jingles. And then we did something. This is a paradox. I was a reformer, always. I was, for penance, chairman of the Ethics Committee, chairman of the committee that reorganized the Senate, led all the horse in the front ranks of all the reform charges, and one of the reforms was to open the doors, to let in the sunshine, much as the delegates to the Constitutional Convention in Pennsylvania in 1787, one of the first things they did was to lock the doors. And that's what we did when it came down to actually representing the public interest by writing in our markup sessions the laws and in our conference committees. But we had to let in the sunshine, let in the people. So we opened the doors, and who'd we let in? We let in the lobbyists and the interest groups, and they multiplied. Mm-hmm. to take advantage of this new access to the political process and the money poured in. And, you know, the last federal election round, $4 billion was invested in our politics. And I don't use that word investment lightly. That money is not coming from those little people on the streets who used to give dollars for Democrats. Those are coming from banks, from big corporate interests, the defense contractors. And we end up with a dysfunctional, and depending on how you look at it, a corrupt government.
It changes the whole nature of things, doesn't it?
Well, it, you know, it just, we've seen it recently, healthcare reform,
mm-hmm.
or tax, reductions, or the banking system. It can, it's only capable at the moment of producing the lowest common denominator of healthcare, rewarding the providers, the insurance companies, and the drug companies. In every other Western democracy, the only option is the public option, a government-managed system that produces better results at half the cost. But that's not even an option here. The banks get bailed out. And, you know, one of the things that he doesn't mention, the president mentions it among many, but when you look at the income and wealth disparities in the United States, these policies are increasing them. With Abraham Lincoln, union required hope and opportunity for all. Government was for as well as of and by all the people. Not any more. The income, the wealth and the growth is all being accumulated at the top. And the working people in this country, their incomes are stagnating or they're losing the, losing them. The income inequalities are at the highest now in the United States since just before the Depression, the Great Depression in 1928, and policies are increasing them.
We're speaking this hour of the program with Senator Adlai Stevenson. His father was actually a hero of mine when I was a little girl because he was a an important person in my family's political circle. His father was Adlai Stevenson, the governor of Illinois and the presidential candidate back in 1952 and 56, ambassador to the United Nations, really a world figure, an important figure in those years in this country. And Senator Stevenson has written about all of the Adlai Stevensons going back to 1930, 1835. He was born in 1930. And it's a rich, rich history. It's also a, there's a lot in the book because his great-grandfather collected words of wisdom, and so he writes about his life and his father's life and his own life and a collection of words of wisdom from many, many years. So here's our phone number. We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There are wonderful quotes from so many great thinkers in the book. Here's a Facebook comment that we received, Senator Stevenson, from Stephen. Who liked this one from your father? My definition of a free society is a society where it is safe to be unpopular.
Yes.
That's a good one.
By the way, Kathleen, that book is called a black book because it, my great-grandfather had a binder in which he stuffed these quotes, anecdotes, aphorisms, and that it expanded over the generations and became known in the family as the Black Book.
Huh.
So those quotes are a lot of them from the Black Book. Do you remember Mike Royko?
Oh, of course.
Well, apparently the Black Book did a lot more for my great-grandfather and my father and their speeches. We used it as a source of material for our speeches.
Right.
He said, I had all the oratorical fire of an algebra teacher. And my speeches made the blood run tepid.
Let's go to Richard in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
When I was a boy, I canvassed for Adley in the 56 election. In 1960, I organized one of the few support organizations for Adley in Kennedy country up here. And because I believe that Adley Stevenson had great analytic powers, was a perceptive politician in the body of a poet, and altogether admirable. And the anecdote I remember is when he got off an airplane, and it reported to him that Norman Vincent Peale had made a nasty remark about him. He smiled and he said something like, "Well, I find Peale appalling and Paul appealing," which is just the sort of style of civilized discourse that one needs. Regrettably, for me, he joined the Kennedy administration in the UN, and I think was I hope an unknowing instrument of Kennedy's nefarious policies in Cuba and Vietnam. For me, Adley Stevenson was the end of a era, and I think it's been all downhill since. Thank you.
Senator Stevenson.
Oh, bless your heart. I remember that the 60 convention. Those conventions debated issues. They really, you know, the primaries were formalities. People converged from all across the country on that convention in Los Angeles in 1960, demanding a third nomination. They literally broke the doors down to the convention. Nowadays, our conventions are media events. You know, it's all decided in primaries and much earlier. That mention of Peale and Paul is it's in the Black Book, and a great many more quotes. One of the things I miss about the old politics is the humor. And in fact, I devote a chapter in this book to the humor. It's drained from our politics. And it wasn't just a way of engaging people. As Lincoln explained, Louis was talking about story. He was a great humorist, too. Can be a very effective way of making your point, or perhaps of denigrating an opponent without being mean-spirited. The Black Book is just rich in humor, mm-hmm. much of which I try to record.
Isn't it? I just think it's so wonderful that you publish this. You're the keeper of the family tradition, and you made it available to everybody. That's wonderful.
Well, there's so much unrecorded history. Our institutional, our memories are short.
Yes.
And as I, do occasional book signings and make talks, it's really. The older people tend to react with nostalgia and some memory, but the younger people, and not a lot of them even, turn up, for them it's a revelation. So I really want to remind people of these enduring values that are more, really in many ways much more timely and important now than they were then. This is a nuclear, interdependent, dynamic, unstable world in which they need to be, reclaimed.
Mm-hmm.
A part of it is enlightened, internationalism, support for the United Nations, and diplomacy as an alternative to war, which is easy. Peace is hard. Those are two chapters.
I'm interested, Senator Stevenson, in this again was in the letter you sent to the president, your warnings of spectacular acts of destruction and disruption and the comprehensive anti-terrorism act of, get this, 1979.
Yeah. Well, this is sort of an example of terrorism didn't become news until it was too late. But my wife and I had trailed the Israeli troops into the West Bank and the Golan Heights in 1967, and had seen and heard in the refugee camps the evidence of ethnic cleansing. I've been back many times to the region, and when the Likud came to power in 77 and systematically began settling these occupied areas, the West Bank and Gaza and Golan Heights. Very timely now, and Egypt was neutralized by Sadat. That was, the peace agreement. It started at Camp David in 77. I thought to myself, they're going to resist. There's going to be resistance. And I began the first in-depth studies of terrorism in the United States, which concluded a year later with those warnings of spectacular acts of destruction and disruption in international, and introduction of that act, and also a separate measure to try to distance the United States from the settlements policy of the Likud. Well, look what's happening in Egypt. I tell you, if there's a popular government in Egypt, they're not going to, it's not going to help the Israelis enforce their siege of Gaza. And that's true. Maybe that's hopeful. Maybe finally, before it's too late, if it's not too late, these events, these instabilities now, will help the United States and Israel and other countries, perhaps Turkey and the United Nations could become involved, could bring peace to that area, including especially and most centrally to the Palestinian issue.
Mm-hmm. It's all quite a whirlwind, isn't it? Tunisia and Egypt and King Abdullah in Jordan getting rid of his cabinet today.
I hadn't even heard that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's extraordinary. And, I really didn't. I mentioned in the Black Book that modern communications, including the Internet, are going to be very, very, very capable of underlining what I called established structures of power. But you can't foresee exactly when or where, but this is happening, I think, in very large part because of the Internet, of Facebook, of Al Jazeera, which is reporting on the ground, and these visions, these images spread instantly throughout the region and excite others to rise up. And these aren't radicals. These are people, many of them very secular. They can be Islamic or secular, but they want freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And they want governments that are responsive to their economic welfare. They're suffering. It's going to be, I think, it creates real risk, but it also creates an opportunity if we're, of course we don't have the influence and the authority we once had in the world, but maybe the UN and Turkey and other countries could be involved. This could create an opportunity. Mohammed al-Barabi, erstwhile the potential leader in Egypt, is a great international figure, Nobel laureate.
Right.
By no means an Islamic radical.
Mm-hmm. Is that what we're worried about? Is that what has kept us endorsing Mubarak? That our fear of the Muslim Brotherhood, et cetera, is larger than need be?
Well, I think so. It goes back to 77 in Camp David. I immediately, when I heard, I met then with Begin and Sadat. I mean, he met with us, senators, and everybody was thrilled. Oh, peace between Israel and Egypt. But I noticed that Egypt's foreign minister immediately resigned. Carter thought he'd gotten promises of, quote, autonomy for the Palestinians, but I heard Begin repudiate any such promises. And then, as I may be repeating now, but I called George Ball, a great diplomat, and said, am I crazy? Or, you know, are there some real seeds of instability here? If the could continues this way, now that, you know, Egypt is neutralized. And George Ball, you know, former deputy secretary of state, ambassador to the UN, my father's colleague, he said, no, you're right, but don't say a word. that would have been very... but now, you know, maybe we'll be shocked into reality, and hopefully this right-wing government in Israel and make a reality of what the United States once supported, the UN supported, and that's a democratic Israel. It's right to exist. It's acknowledged by everybody. The 67 lines, the rough... The outlines are there. The Arab League has all, you know, endorsed them. But this government in Israel persists defiantly, you know, slapping Obama in the face to continue with their settlements, including settlements in East Jerusalem. Now, maybe this will, hopefully, this will chasten them.
We're speaking with former U.S. Senator Adlai Stevenson this hour of our program, and he is the compiler of the Black Book, American Politics and History as Experienced by Five Generations of an American Family. His father, of course, was former governor and presidential, Democratic presidential candidate, Adlai Stevenson. We have a couple lines open, and we have quite a few emails that have come in. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Former U.S. Senator Adlai Stevenson is our guest this hour, and he's written a book which was actually started by his great-grandfather, Vice President Adlai Stevenson, who lived from 1835 to 1914. It's also his father and also his collections of material that they used when jokes and philosophy, and also interspersed in the book a great deal of information about the Stevenson family in Illinois and way beyond Illinois, because they very much became people of the world. Let's go to Kenneth in Janesville next, Senator Stevenson. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello.
Hi.
I think the world should be... and is, I think, eternally grateful for Adlai Stevenson III being at the United Nations during the Cuban Missile Crisis. In that time when at night we faced south waiting for Chicago to be wiped off the map. Adlai Stevenson was on primetime TV. I mean, the UN debates were televised, and I think he was in the right. I mean, things happen for a reason. He was in the right place at the right time.
Senator Stevenson, your thoughts?
First, that was Adlai two, not three. That was my father. Unlike the Colin Powell presentation on Iraq, he presented eloquently and forcibly indisputable, you know, evidence of the missiles, and challenged, you know, Zorin, the Republican, maybe the Russian representative, who couldn't respond, and it was very dramatic, and unlike the Iraq presentation later, the whole world, you know, rose up to support the United States. But there's a story here that's maybe still timely. My father tried to persuade the Kennedy administration to trade off some obsolete bases in Turkey to the Soviets in exchange for removal of these missiles. He wanted to avoid war. And he also wanted to avoid humiliating Khrushchev, whom he knew. And then certain individuals in the White House vilified my father. They said he accused him of calling for a Munich. And then they proceeded in secret to do exactly the deal that he had proposed.
Oh, interesting.
But with the condition to the Soviets that it be kept secret. Well, then exactly what my father feared happened. Khrushchev was humiliated. He fell, and there was a group that followed from which emerged Brezhnev, the hardliner. And Cold War and the arms race escalated. Just exactly. But why? Why was that? Because we have to be tough. Being for peace really requires toughness.
I didn't know that was your father's idea. That's interesting.
Yeah, no, he believed in diplomacy as an alternative to war. And it might have, you know, made a difference. Maybe the arms race could have been, he'd started the, you know, efforts to control the strategic arms race. Of course, now it's unbridled. It's just taken off. But, yeah, he was a peacemaker.
Thank you, Kenneth. Jeff in Madison, hi.
Hi. I'd like to know what your dad thought of actually his general and maybe specific opinions and impressions of the Kennedy family, specifically John, who he worked for, actually, and Bobby, and later your impressions of Ted.
Of Ted? Oh, Ted and I went to school together.
Oh, did you?
We were schoolmates. I was a year ahead of him. He was not the... Neither of us were great students, but I think I was a little better than he was. I was very fond of him. Ted was a, you know, sort of a very traditional, classical, liberal Democrat, very much focused on social welfare and education and, of course, health, for which he became famous. I was much more focused on peace and the world and international economics, economic competitiveness, and so on, but he came out to Illinois, you know, to campaign for me. We were friends. Now, I knew Jack Kennett. We called him Jack going way back. He came to Libertyville, the home, once, and indirectly offered my father the position of Secretary of State if he would just, you know, support his campaign, his candidacy in 1960. And my father was what was then called the titular leader of the party, with strong supporters, among others Eleanor Roosevelt, to whom, as I mentioned a moment ago, they wanted him to run again. They were supporting him. Well, he didn't want to run, compete in the primaries, but he thought he ought to be neutral and be faithful to his neutral as titular leader and faithful to his supporters. So he did not, take the deal. But there was always mutual respect between John F. Kennedy and my father. And I can remember at the 56th convention, this is after I had returned from Korea and the Marines. I missed the 52 campaign. the outcome of the presidential nominating was foreordained. Put some excitement into the convention, my father opened up the race for vice president. And that came down to a contest between Kennedy and Estes Kefauver. And we were rooting in my father's, you know, suite in the south side of Chicago for Jack Kennedy. And at one point, I raced downstairs to his suite, past Sergeant Shriver. Kennedy was pulling up his trousers as if he was, you know, about to go down to the convention to accept the nomination. I congratulated him and race back upstairs just in time to see Estes Kefauver win. But having said that, there was a circle known as the Irish Mafia around John F. Kennedy that was always very hostile to my father. And I don't know why. I think they sort of feared him because he was a force within the within the party. And Bobby Kennedy was always kind of, you know, near that part of the camp. There was Kenny McDonnell. They call it the Irish Mafia, but and Larry O'Brien confessed later, you know, and apologized. But they were always, I don't know, fearful, jealous, resentful because he hadn't. In fact, Bobby was explicitly resentful because he had not supported Kennedy at the 60 convention. But as between John F. and my father, there was mutual respect there. And Mrs. Kennedy, Jackie, who was kind of my contemporary, I knew her slightly, going way back, she used to sort of escape the Kennedy clan and their football weekends at Bobby's, go to New York to go out to the theater with Governor's Ambassador Stevens.
Ah.
She was an intellectual, lovely, you know, lovely lady. We were very fond of
her. Yeah, of her. Here's an email from Lynn in Rushford, Minnesota, Governor Stevenson. The first time I ever saw tears in my mother's eyes was when Adlai Stevenson lost the 1956 election. I was a child and puzzled about this, so I asked her why she was crying. She said, "He is such a good man. We needed him to be our president." Years later, I heard a recording of speeches by Stevenson, and one of his quotes confirmed for me what my mother had said. It was, "All wars are civil wars because all men are brothers."
Yeah, that's a beautiful one. I don't remember that one.
Hmm. Well, there you go. Another one for the next edition of the Black Book, sir. Right.
By the way, if anybody wants to get the Black Book, it's available on my website.
Oh, please. Yeah, you have a website. Okay.
That's the easiest, cheapest. It's, you can be ordered to the bookstores and Amazon.com, but the easiest is Adlai3.com, www.adlai3.com.
Adlai3.com.
Number3.com.
Number3.com. All right, that's good and easy. And somebody wanted us to remember the famous photo of your dad and his worn shoe soles.
Nowadays, he'd be accused of, you know, faking it, but I was there. That was Hamtramck, Michigan, with Governor Menin Williams, and it was, you know, totally unaffected. He was on the platform, somebody looked up, and there was a big hole in the sole of his shoe. And it became a trademark.
Now, it's usual for most sons of famous people to go in a different direction, to rebel a little bit. You are very much your father's son.
I was born with an incurable, hereditary case of politics. And everything I did in my life, starting in school, studying government, going to law school, very frankly, enlisting in the Marines and volunteering for combat, everything was, and then, you know, clerking for a Supreme Court justice and practicing law for, everything was aimed at preparing for a political career, and I insisted against my father's advice. Sorry to brag, but I insisted on starting at the bottom and working up from the precincts to the State House of Representatives. And yeah, I just, oh, God. Well, but today, I don't think I'd be very keen. Today, it's money raising. I never dialed for dollars.
Didn't have it in you. Yeah.
I didn't have to either, you know. But who would invest in me?
I think a lot of people would.
I learned that as state treasurer. You know, bankers had been well trained to invest in the state treasurer. Well, they learned in a hurry. this politics, it's very challenging for the totally incorruptible person who, and one, you know, with some experience and some knowledge of the issues. It's very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
There are wonderful people out there still struggling. And this book is, you know, as you've probably read, is dedicated to them. Those who do try to carry on and with some hopes that it gives them some encouragement is, you know, well, some wisdom and maybe some humor.
Yes, and there is much of that. Oh, it has been such a privilege to have a chance to speak with you. I must say, I hope my grandmother has listened from her grave. It was just wonderful. You're quite a guy. Thank you.
Kathleen, you're wonderful.
Oh, you are. Thank you. Our guest this hour, former U.S. Senator Adlai Stevenson. The book is The Black Book, American Politics and History as Experienced by Five Generations of an American Family. And as the senator said, you can go to Adlai, that's spelled A-D-L-A-I, 1-2-3, because he's the third, AdlaiStevenson.com. It's Adlai123.com. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.